will be no foolish wand-waving or silly incantations in this class. As such, I don't expect many of you to appreciate the subtle science and exact art that is potion-making. However, for those select few who possess the predisposition, I can teach you how to bewitch the mind and ensnare the senses. I can tell you how to bottle fame, brew glory, and even put a stopper in death.
In late 2005, Alan Rickman, one of the most admired and acclaimed actors of his generation, who epitomized the archetype of cinematic villains with his portrayals of many of the most famous bad guys in movie history, from Hans Gruber to the Sheriff of Nottingham to Severus Snape and others, was diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer. His doctors ordered his prostate to be removed immediately, and even then, his prognosis was uncertain. Rickman was notoriously private, and it seems that no one other than his doctors and his lifetime partner, Rima Horton, knew of his cancer diagnosis. Rickman instead confessed all to his diaries, which he religiously maintained from 1993 through the end of his life, and which Horton published posthumously. He wrote that he intended to fight the cancer with everything he had, but that he was naturally scared of being put under anesthesia and, of course, the potential for a negative outcome. The timing of the diagnosis wasn't altogether unlucky for Rickman. The fourth installment of the Harry Potter movies, The Goblet of Fire, was just coming out in theaters, and shooting had not yet begun on its sequel, The Order of the Phoenix. If necessary, Rickman noted, the franchise could transition to a new actor to fill the role of the dark and menacing Severus Snape, just as it had when Michael Gambon replaced Richard Harris as Professor Dumbledore between the second and third movies. Fortunately, however, the surgery was successful, and weeks later, in a diary entry on January 30, 2006, Rickman wrote that he was ready to commit himself to the character once again and to see it through to the end. Rickman wrote, "Finally, yes to HP5. The argument that wins is the one that says, see it through. It's your story." Over the next 10 years, Rickman appeared in 22 more movies, including the final four Harry Potter films, and he starred in a number of plays in London and New York. The cancer was at bay, and he remained healthy and strong, working constantly while devoting almost all of his free time to left-leaning political and charitable causes. But in August 2015, Rickman suffered a stroke in his London home and was rushed to the hospital. The stroke was minor and didn't cause any damage, but tests doctors performed into the underlying cause revealed that Rickman had pancreatic cancer. As he had in 2005, Rickman kept the cancer diagnosis private and threw all of his strength and resources into the fight to live. But by this time, the cancer had advanced too far, and just before Christmas 2015, fatigued and crippled with pain, he checked himself into the hospital. He hoped it would be a short stay and made plans to see friends for Christmas and then again for New Year's, but he was forced to cancel both times because he was just too exhausted. Soon it became clear the end was near. Rima Horton would later write, "The last 2 weeks of Alan's life were extraordinary. It was clear that he was dying. There was nothing more they could do other than preventing him from being in pain, which they did. Different friends came in each day. Sometimes, Alan told me who he wanted to see. Other times, they just came in." On the morning of January 14, 2016, too tired to keep on fighting, Rickman said he wanted to sleep, and so he closed his eyes and drifted off one last time. Alan Rickman was 69 years old. I'm Jason Beckerman.
I'm Derek Kaufman.
This is Last Days, Alan Rickman.
As we've previously talked about in our episode on Steve Jobs and Patrick Swayze, pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of the disease, not because it's hard to treat, but because it's exceptionally difficult to detect. Pancreatic cancer presents few symptoms in its early stages, and by the time they do present, including jaundice, substantial weight loss, and severe urinary and gastrointestinal issues, it's often too late. Moreover, late-stage pancreatic cancer is correlated with a markedly elevated risk of ischemic stroke, just like the one suffered by Rickman. So it is likely doctors knew very quickly Rickman didn't have long to live. But true to the kind of person he was, Rickman put on an optimistic face for Rima and tried to avoid being a burden or breed concern among his many close friends. Indeed, though he made a career portraying a range of nasty and malevolent characters, the real-life Rickman was enormously kind and generous, a philanthropist, a mentor, and one of the most affable men there ever was. Kate Winslet, who starred with Rickman in Sense and Sensibility, deeply mourned his death, stating in part that he was an unusually kind and generous person. He was adored by his co-stars, including in particular Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson, both of whom were just 11 years old when they first began working with Rickman in the Harry Potter movies, and were each quietly suffering from the significant challenges they faced dealing with the public scrutiny that came with overnight superstardom. Each credited Rickman as being their most important ally and mentor during the early years, describing him as always encouraging, supportive, and kindly constructive, even as they sometimes felt overlooked by the other adults in charge. Watson said Rickman mentored her with, quote, warmth, humor, and patience, and Radcliffe said he was, quote, one of the greatest actors I will ever work with, and one of the loyalest and most supportive people I've ever met in the film industry. Radcliffe said the two remained friends throughout Rickman's life, noting that he was so encouraging of me both on set and in the years post-Potter. I'm pretty sure he came and saw everything I ever did on stage, both in London and New York. He didn't have to do that. I know people who've been friends with him for much, much longer than I have, and they all say, if you call Alan, it doesn't matter where in the world he is or how busy he is with what he's doing. He'll get back to you.
And it's precisely this, Rickman's gentility and kindness, loyalty and generosity, that made his intensely villainous performances so brilliant and beautifully ironic. And it began right from the start. Rickman's first major role was as the depraved Vicomte de Valmont in the 1986 Broadway production of Dangerous Liaisons. His performance would land Rickman a Tony nomination, but more importantly, it caught the eye of a big-shot Hollywood producer named Joel Silver, who was busy casting for an upcoming project called Die Hard. Silver offered Rickman the gig without an audition because he knew he would be perfect for the part, and he was right. Rickman embodied the Hans Gruber character with a blend of sophistication, wit, and menace that would become the blueprint for future cinematic villains.
Here. And when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Benefits of a classical education.
Derek, this marked a huge turning point in the way villains were portrayed in cinema. I hadn't really thought about this until I started prepping for this podcast, and there's a lot written about how Alan Rickman, as Hans Gruber, changed the way that antagonists were in action films. Previously, they had relied on their overwhelming physical prowess, if you think of like the Terminator or Darth Vader.
They're imposing their physical presences, right, who are menacing.
And if
that's not this
case. And if they weren't, they were malevolent to the extreme and deranged. Jack Nicholson in The Joker. We have Norman Bates in Psycho. Jack Torrance in The Shining. These weren't physically imposing people, but they were so deranged,
yeah,
to be villainous.
The scary thing is that they were crazy. That's
right.
Rickman was cool and controlled as Hans Gruber. It is a seminal text. There's no two ways about it. Die Hard, for many reasons, in the action genre is a seminal text in what it did with the hero of it as well, with John McClane. But it's Rickman in a suit.
Right.
He is not menacing. He's not carrying a shotgun. He's not carrying a machine gun. He is just brilliant.
The suit point is really important because it was written in the script as him wearing army fatigues and a gun strapped to his leg. And he said, and Rickman went to the producers and said, this is not who this guy is. He's not a warrior. And he said that would be inauthentic because the way Rickman looks, his appearance, I'm not going to be the kind of guy who's out like as a terrorist.
Yes.
He goes, I'm in a suit and tie. I'm the intellectual.
I love it too, because Hans Gruber for me is the greatest movie villain maybe of all time, because he's playing a chess game. And right, cinematically, you're not watching someone. Look, I love Rambo. I love big action movies as well where they shoot machine guns. But what he's doing is the chess game. And because of his intellect and the way he delivered his lines, he seems like he's two steps ahead of cops,
yeah,
like John McClane.
That's right.
And so he is the most imposing kind of villain.
He really did play it as sly and cultured, methodical. He was as intellectual as he was ruthless. His ruthlessness came from his advanced intelligence, not based on, again, his overwhelming physical prowess.
And a total lack of empathy. So when you're, yep, in that suit, the thing about Hans Gruber is he'll kill his own men,
right,
he'll kill you,
right,
and you never know, you're never at ease because you feel like he's outthought you and he's willing to do things that you wouldn't and a normal person with feelings would do.
But there were rules to the game. The greatest turn in that movie is when John McClane, playing the cop, realizes that initially Rickman makes up that they want to get hostages released from around the world. But what Bruce Willis realizes is he's just a common thief. He just wants the money. And Rickman doesn't deny it. He said, well, I'm a very exceptional thief. But that's who he is. He's just trying for the money,
yeah,
but he pretends to be this sort of traitorous, you know, terrorist. But he's not.
Still the cowboy, Mr. McClane. Americans all alike. Well, this time John Wayne does not walk off into the sunset with Grace Kelly.
It's Gary Cooper, asshole.
Enough jokes.
And I want to say he truly, the Hans Gruber character truly defined what villainy was going forward. It's not as if this was a one-off. If you watch movies like Cliffhanger, John Lithgow is doing a Hans Gruber. That's all he is. He's out after the money. He's smooth talking. He's with a British accent. That became a trope in and of itself. And Alan Rickman invented it. Out of whole cloth.
There's Thanos, one of the greatest villains in modern cinema. He's obviously physically very mighty.
But he's calm.
He's calm.
Yeah.
He's intellectual. He's smarter than the other people. And that's what makes Thanos so terrifying is his intelligence. And I don't want to be too much on Hans Gruber's plate, but I think it comes from that role. Let's take a quick ad break and we'll be back after this.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, and Walmart, and even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. So download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. R-A-K-U-T-E-N.
Imagine that movie without Alan Rickman. It just doesn't work, and he so embodies that role. And it really almost didn't happen. Rickman said he nearly turned down the role because he didn't want to do action movies. He was not interested. He was more of a thespian. He was doing theater. But he later acknowledged that decision would have been colossally stupid. The movie ends up making $150 million worldwide, and it turned Rickman almost overnight into an enormous star, like Bruce Willis, who had already had, I guess, you know, moonlighting, but it turned them into massive stars. So much so that 3 months later, Rickman was cast as the malevolent Sheriff of Nottingham in one of the most anticipated movies of 1991, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, opposite Kevin Costner, who at this point was a huge movie star. To be fair, the movie's not great, and Costner's performance was panned in particular because he toggled between English and American accents, apparently because he was filming the whole thing during a few weeks of breaks from shooting Dances with Wolves, and he just didn't have time to master it.
Yeah.
So you're watching this movie, and Robin Hood is like kind of American sometimes, kind of British.
It starts out with him, you know, in the Crusades, and he's in this prison, and he's got this thick British accent, and by the time, like 20 minutes into the movie, he's back in England, he's lost the accent, but it's okay. I mean, the movie's not meant to be.
Yeah, part of what elevates. I mean, look, Roger Ebert was unsparing towards Kevin Costner. Yeah. He called the movie, quote, murky, unfocused, violent, and depressing, and he panned Costner's performance. But what's interesting is he called Rickman, quote, a wicked, droll, sly, witty master who creates the most colorful character in the movie with a performance so good it was almost inappropriate for this film. And it says it all right there. He elevated bad material. Right. That's what Rickman would do, kind of like Philip Seymour Hoffman. You just wanted to watch it.
Yeah, I watched the movie a couple weeks ago. I'd listened to a podcast about the movie, and I watched the movie a couple weeks ago, and knowing we were going to do this podcast, the movie's not as bad as I remember. I remember seeing it in theaters. It came out in 91. I hated it at the time because it was so farcical. But
had that Bryan Adams song.
Yeah,
that was omnipresent on the radio. It was a big deal.
But it's not as bad as I remember. Costner is pretty bad. But you do have to give him some credit. He was doing Dancing with Wolves at the same time. That ends up, he wins the acting award, the directing award for the same movie. He's got a lot on his plate. But Rickman is really great. He's really funny, and there are some really corny lines in the movie that would have been awful in the hands of a lesser actor, but somehow Rickman really does pull them off.
Just a minute. Robin Hood steals money from my pocket, forcing me to hurt the public, and they love him for it?
Yes.
That's it then. Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
So in the wake of Robin Hood, Rickman scored some non-villainous parts in the 1990s. He was cast as a romantic lead in Sense and Sensibility opposite Kate Winslet, as an insufferable scientist in the satirical Galaxy Quest, and even as one of Heaven's Angels in Dogma. But Rickman's performances in these movies are almost entirely forgotten. It is the villains we remember because Rickman was so damn good at playing them. And I think there's no greater example than that than in Love Actually. You know, it's one of the great romantic comedies ever. It's
this
beloved.
Is an important text for Jason. Yeah, Love Actually.
I do like Love Actually quite a bit.
That's the sensitive underbelly of that's right. Jason Beckerman.
It's really funny, and there are some good tear-jerking parts of it. But what's remarkable about it, so it's a beloved romantic comedy, right? The movie ends with every single actor in the huge ensemble playing characters that find the loves of their life, except for Alan Rickman. His character gets caught cheating on his wife, and it ends the movie. He ends the movie alone. He's never redeemed. He plays the one character among the 20. There's 20 people in this ensemble. He's the one character, every one of which, by the way, all the 20 have foibles. They make mistakes. They're imperfect. He's the one that ends up suffering any consequences at all. Even the guy who's obsessed with his best friend's new bride, he like tries to make overtures to steal his best friend's new bride. He ends up fine. He's happy. He gets over it. Not poor Alan Rickman.
I'm trying to put my finger on what it is we love about Rickman so much. And it dawned on me that he always knows what movie he's in. And what I mean by that
I think it's a really good point.
Yeah, like when he's in Die Hard, there are funny moments in Die Hard. And he knows how to play the humor without losing the thread that the movie is a serious action movie. And he's not winking, but what he is he's aware and he knows how to deliver that. You see it in, you certainly see it in Love Actually as well. You see it in Galaxy Quest where that is a full over-the-top farce. And so he's playing it like a full over-the-top farce. He is chewing up the scenery. He's winking. He's making the line sort of heavy.
But he doesn't, in the action movies especially, in Die Hard especially, he's funny, but he never
but
gets
menacing.
So funny that he loses the threat, the fear that you fear of him. Same thing with him as Sheriff Nottingham. You know, it's the same thing. And then when you get to Snape, which we'll talk about in a minute, Severus Snape, he's not really funny, but there's more going on behind his eyes and the way he delivers words that just elevate him to a place that no other villain that I can remember gets to. I really do think Josh Brolin, now that, as Thanos, there's obviously also CGI going and stuff. There's a menace to him.
Oh, sure.
That I think really builds on what Rickman was doing. But he's just better.
He communicates that complication and that nuance better than most actors out there, and in material that often doesn't deserve it. But despite all the great parts he played with such mastery, it's Rickman's portrayal of Severus Snape in the Harry Potter movies that really forever defines him, particularly with younger generations. The character was a major player in the Potter universe, figuring heavily in each of the series' 8 movies. And anyone who reads the books after watching the movies will undoubtedly hear Rickman's double bass voice behind the words. The Potter movie sets were notoriously difficult. Actors feuded with directors, who feuded with producers, kids pissed off adults, shootings went too long, and costs really grew out of proportion. There were locations that were too cold and uncomfortable. And Rickman himself often complained to producers and others about the direction of his character and the pace of the shoots. But whatever his misgivings behind the scenes, his portrayal of Snape was a towering success. Jason, you and I always think of him as Hans Gruber. That's just the age bracket that we're in. But we are in the minority, decidedly. Because to the world, Alan Rickman, the world at large, he's Severus Snape.
Right.
The movies earned $7.7 billion at the box office, making it one of the biggest film franchises ever. Do you know what the biggest ones are?
Well, the Marvel MCU is clearly the biggest, especially if you include like the Spider-Mans and stuff like that. I think it's in the 20 billion.
Number one. You can't keep up with the Avengers.
And it must be Star Wars. I know James Bond is huge.
James Bond has so many movies.
So many movies.
I mean, the James Bond universe is 20 plus movies.
Right. And then DC and Batman. So I'm going to go with fifth.
It's third.
Third.
It is third. It's behind
it's bigger than James Bond?
MCU and Star Wars. Isn't that incredible?
It's incredible.
I mean, the franchise is massive. And Alan Rickman really is the glue of that franchise because you've got clearly Harry Potter is the hero of the movie. But you need the complication of a character like Severus Snape, who is kind of the heavy or one of the bad guys for about 7.5 of these movies.
But then you learn at the end of it that he's actually
he was the good guy.
And you go back and if you watch him again, like I did with my kids, you see it all along. You can find it there all along.
You can see it communicated. But again, this is the nuance he brings because in the early movies when, you know, these are 11-year-olds walking around the dark hallways of Hogwarts and you hear that voice behind you when he's sort of spotting Potter up to no good or them sort of prowling around, he's menacing and he's scary. And then it gradually changes.
Even his cadence, the way he slows his words almost to a pause to build tension and then quickly has the shoe drop. It's terrifying. He's really, really good at it.
In the past, it was often the Dark Lord's pleasure to invade the minds of his victims, creating visions designed to torture them into madness. Only after extracting the last X
exquisite ants of agony. Only when he had them literally begging for death would he finally kill them. Used properly, the power of our clemency will help shield you from access or influence. In these lessons, I will attempt to penetrate your mind. You will attempt to resist. Prepare yourself.
We mentioned earlier that Rickman's longtime partner, Rima Horton, published Rickman's diaries after he died. Rickman and Horton had been together since 1965, when he was just 19, though they waited until 2012 to get married. They did not have children, and very little is known about their relationship. As noted, Rickman was extremely private, and he instructed Horton to destroy his diaries upon his death, but she was not so inclined, and in 2022, she published all 27 volumes he'd compiled during his life. This decision obviously generated criticism and controversy, and it also piqued the public's curiosity. Thousands of copies sold and dozens of newspapers and websites summarized the juicy tidbits for their readers, including Rickman's not-so-nice thoughts about the second Harry Potter movie, quote, "I want to bang the producers' heads against the nearest wall," and about his child co-stars, saying Daniel Radcliffe, quote, "may not really be an actor," and that Emma Watson's, quote, "diction is this side of Albania at times." But these were private thoughts, and though it's hard not to take a kind of perverse interest in the gossipy parts of what he wrote, it's undeniably shameful that his wife published them over his express instructions. Even a man who built such an immaculate reputation as Rickman gets knocked down a peg or two when people find out he's written catty things about child actors. That's undoubtedly unfair, given the context in which he wrote the comments, and let's not forget, Rickman was absolutely adored by the very children he wrote these things about, so whatever misgivings he might have had about them in private about their acting prowess, he was undoubtedly good to them. Indeed, it seems that off-screen, Rickman was good to everyone. He apparently left much of his fortune to cancer charities, to which he devoted enormous amounts of time and money during his life, and it's really hard to find a negative word anyone has said about the man. As famed director Kevin Smith succinctly put it, Alan Rickman was, quote, "talented and awesome." Smith directed Rickman in Dogma and developed a lifelong friendship with him. Smith said, quote, "Alan Rickman is one of my favorite people who ever lived. I loved Hans Gruber the minute I saw Die Hard, but I fell in love with the soft-spoken, gentle soul who brought Gruber to life. I had the privilege of working with Alan Rickman. He elevated every flicker of the script he was given to 24 frames worth of genius. He was, hands down, the greatest actor I've ever had the pleasure to watch perform. I learned so much from him. He made whatever he was in better. But man, I wish more of Rickman had rubbed off on me. I might have been better, too."